Majoub al-Aradi worked as a gardener for bin Laden when he lived in Sudan. In November 2001, the London newspaper Al-Quds al-Arabi published al-Aradi's account of his time with bin Laden in Sudan. Excerpts from the Al-Quds article follows. Bin Laden used to live in a two-story house in Al-Riyadh suburb east of Khartoum and would receive his guests at another house similar to the first one. He had an office on Makhnimar Street. Al-Aradi, 74 years old, worked for Osama bin Laden for 4 years up to the moment he left Sudan. Al-Aradi said there were many guests who used to visit bin Laden during daytime, including Egyptian and Yemeni men wearing the traditional long dress. Very often these people would bring their families, many of whom left with bin Laden, to Afghanistan. Al-Aradi said bin Laden had 4 wives, 4 sons, Abdullah, Abd al-Rahman, Ahmad and Muhammad, and a very young daughter. His son, Abdullah, went to Saudi Arabia, where he married his cousin. Osama bin Laden made his 3 other sons leave school to attend lessons on the recital of the Quran by 2 teachers from West Sudan. Regarding his activity in Khartoum, al-Aradi said Osama bin Laden was always escorted by special guards, in addition to guards in front of his house who would sit in a ground-level place where they could clearly see others. The guards carried machine guns to protect bin Laden's homes and would accompany bin Laden on his trips outside Khartoum. Every day, bin Laden would go to the office and then to his guest house, where he would stay until 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, after which he would return to his houses. He used to like farming, and he contributed to planting vast areas with watermelon. This helped decrease the price of watermelon. He was also interested in training police dogs. Al-Aradi said bin Laden used to eat a little amount of food and would eat the leftovers from guests because he thought this was a blessing taught by the Prophet. Bin Laden used to dress simply. He often wore a long dress and long headdress and shoes open at the back. Scott McLeod, a correspondent for Time magazine, interviewed bin Laden in the spring of 1996 while he was living in Sudan. He was at that time building a road in Sudan from Khartoum to Port Sudan, and he owned a sunflower seed plantation and owned a tanning factory. And he went to great pains to show me all this. Clearly, he was trying to present the image that, look, I'm a businessman, I have my problems with the Saudi government, I won't deny them, and he ran through a litany of why the Saudi government was corrupt or illegitimate. But he said, the way of fighting this is not violent, we're politicians. He was at pains to show me the non-military side of Osama bin Laden. If he was purely involved in business, this is what I would have seen. It was a very normal sort of third-world business setting. Khaled al-Fawaz, a Saudi, worked both as bin Laden's media representative in London and for the Advice and Reformation Committee, a political organization founded by bin Laden in 1994, that ostensibly worked non-violently to reform the Saudi regime. I visited him once, at least in Sudan, and when I observed his house and his way of living, I couldn't believe my eyes. He has no fridge at home, no air conditioning, no refrigerator, no fancy car. He also took me to a large farm where he was doing experimental plantings of unusual trees. He wanted to encourage me to invest in Sudan. I was not convinced. I thought Sudan was difficult to invest in because of their regulations. At that time, I was in the food import-export business. Osama said, you should grow food in Sudan and then export it to Saudi Arabia. He's a millionaire and he is keeping his money for the general Muslim cause and also for supporting reforms back home in Saudi Arabia. People can only respect him more and more because of that. The Advice and Reformation Committee is not a new thing. It is simply a continuation of the reforming business in Saudi Arabia, which was there for decades. We thought of uniting this effort. It's also going to make our project stronger because when individual people speak about reforms to the Saudi regime, they will think these are isolated individuals who are not happy with what's going on. But if an organization started to speak about this, Then the regime should understand that this is something serious. Abu Anas, bin Laden's old friend, visited Sudan in late 1994. Anas arrived around the time that a group of Takfiris, an ultra-Islamist group who considered bin Laden to be a heretic, mounted a serious assassination attempt against the Saudi exile. Abu Anas. I was in Sudan when the attempt against bin Laden happened. They just came straight to the house of Osama and they started to shoot. They fired on the walls of the guest house. They were Takfiris that considered bin Laden not sufficiently Muslim. Some of them were from Libya. Takfiris, very crazy, very crazy. They kill everybody. Sheikh Abdul Ghaffar, the imam of the Khartoum mosque where bin Laden worshipped. A lot of the neighbors of Osama bin Laden, they were against him being here in Sudan. We lived here for several years before Sheikh Osama joined this area. It was a very calm area. Those people tried to kill Osama bin Laden. Our area was closed for more than 18 hours as some people from the government tried to catch the group. It was a terrible accident for us in this area. And all of us, we asked Sheikh Osama to leave this area. We prayed that he would leave. One of bin Laden's former neighbors, the landlord of a house that stands next to Osama's old residence in Khartoum, he refused to give his name. They were members of the Takfiri sect. It was Friday, just before sunset. One of the gunmen appeared racing down bin Laden's street, spraying bullets at his house and the guards. He turned up the side road where a guard shot the tires of the gunman's car. The whole thing lasted a quarter of an hour. After the attack, security was stepped up. A large ditch was dug in the street, blocking passage from the main road, and additional armed guards were posted. The only entrance was by way of a small side street off the soccer field. There, too, a ditch was dug, but smaller, so cars could still pass. But the ditch gave cars a good audible bump, so guards were alerted to unexpected visitors. Bin Laden left several months later, moving out quietly without warning. One morning, bin Laden and his guards were there, the next, they were gone. After Osama moved out, the Chinese embassy took it over as their residence. Abu Jandal, bin Laden's chief bodyguard in 2000. According to what I heard about that case from Sheikh Osama himself, he had a licensed gun which never left his pocket. A group of his followers were also armed. Sheikh Osama was ready to leave his home, heading to the office, but he was delayed by a talk between him and his son, Abdullah. During that period, he was readying his family for a more austere life, to be content with a simple life away from all the luxuries. His son, Abdullah, opposed that idea. His point of view was that his father was a millionaire and that they were supposed to enjoy that wealth. That talk with his son delayed him, while his bodyguards had already left for the office. So his attackers were deceived, thinking that Sheikh Osama was in his office with his guards. They started firing directly at the office while Sheikh Osama was still at home. He and his son were armed. When he heard the gunfire, he came out of the house and saw armed men shooting at his office, while at the same time attacking his guards. Sudanese security was also present. He and his son attacked them from the other side, so the attackers were besieged. Some were killed and others wounded, while the rest escaped. Later it became clear that the attackers were members of an Islamic group that had declared bin Laden an infidel. In December 1992, President George H.W. Bush dispatched 28,000 U.S. troops for Operation Restore Hope, a humanitarian mission to feed hundreds of thousands of starving Somalis embroiled in a civil war sweeping their country. Al-Qaeda saw the arrival of those troops in Somalia 2 years after the introduction of hundreds of thousands of American troops into Saudi Arabia as part of a larger strategy to take over the Islamic world. Jamal Fadl. In Sobatan, we got Big Farm also belonged to the group. Every Thursday after the sunset prayer, if any of Al-Qaeda's membership, they are in Khartoum that day, they have to come to the meeting in the farm. And it's lecture by bin Laden and other membership about jihad and our agenda. I was in the guest house, and they talk after Iraq government took Kuwait. in 1990, following which 500,000 U.S. troops were posted to Saudi Arabia. After a few months, they say, American army now, they should leave the Gulf area. I hear from Abu Abdallah, Osama bin Laden himself. We cannot let the American army stay in the Gulf area and take our oil, take our money, and we have to do something to take them out. We have to fight them. After that, also, we got another fatwa because they say the American army come to the Horn of Africa in Somalia. Also, I was in the guest house and Abu Ubaidah al-Banshiri, he talk about that. He says, the American army in Horn of Africa in Somalia, and now they already took off Gulf area, and now they go to Somalia. And if they are successful in Somalia, the next thing it could be the south of Sudan and other Islamic countries. In the big guest house, bin Laden say about American army, now they came to the Horn of Africa, and we have to stop the head of the snake. He said that the snake is America, and we have to stop them. We have to cut the head and stop them. They sent Abu Hafs to Somalia, to Mogadishu. And he went to see they can do something over there.
This ends Disc 5. The Osama bin Laden I Know. Disc 6.
Abdel Bari Atwan, the editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi newspaper. Bin Laden told me that he was expecting the Americans to come to Somalia, and he sent people a month before their arrival to be prepared. And when they came, actually, he attacked them. But unfortunately, according to him, they ran away. And he wanted them to stay in order to fight them. He told me that the American soldiers were cowards in comparison with the Soviet soldiers. I think he was telling the truth about Somalia. He sent people from Al-Jihad, the Egyptian Al-Jihad troops. Abu Jandal. The impact of international developments on Somalia and the entry of the U.S. forces into it were Osama bin Laden's justification for the entry of Al-Qaeda into the country. Al-Qaeda viewed the entry of the Americans into Somalia not as a move that is meant to save the Somalis from famine, but to control Somalia and then spread U.S. hegemony over the region. This will achieve several goals. First, it will strike the growing Islamic movement in Sudan. Second, it will set up a rear U.S. base in the Gulf, since Somalia was the closest point to the Arabian Gulf. I did not take part in any battles in Somalia because when I entered Somalia, Al-Qaeda organization itself had started to leave Somalia. Mohammed Sadiq Odeh, who is of Palestinian heritage, joined Al-Qaeda in 1992. As a member of Al-Qaeda, he traveled to Somalia in 1993 and 1997. FBI agents interviewed him in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, from August 15th through August 28th, 1998, following Al-Qaeda's attack on the U.S. embassy there. Excerpts of their report follow. Odeh stated that he left Palestine to attend Far Eastern University in Manila, Philippines, in late 1986 to pursue studies in engineering and architecture. Odeh became interested in the jihad. Odeh is indoctrinated by watching videotapes and listening to cassette tapes of Abdullah Azam, who is the leader of the Arabs fighting in Afghanistan. Odeh was attracted to Osama bin Laden and the group Al-Qaeda because it did not matter what nationality you were. Odeh was first approached by Al-Qaeda while he was still at the basic training camp. Odeh's behavior, his ability to work with others, his knowledge of the religion and respect towards others were the reasons he was approached. Odeh stated that eventually 1 year passed before he decided to make bayat, an oath to bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Odeh made bayat and officially joined Al-Qaeda in March 1992. Odeh stated that he was ordered to Somalia in March 1993 by Emir Saif al-Adil, one of the Egyptian military commanders of Al-Qaeda, which was coming from Osama bin Laden. Odeh was told by al-Adil that jihad in Afghanistan was over and that they were moving to do jihad elsewhere. Odeh stated that his mission in Somalia was to train some of the tribes in fighting and to provide food and money. The position of Al-Qaeda regarding aid to Somalia by civilian organizations was that it was acceptable. It was, however, unacceptable for U.S. armed troops to be in Somalia. Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda considered this colonization. Abu Hafs, Mohammed Atif, was sent by bin Laden to assess the situation in Mogadishu. Somali leaders, General Mohammed Farah Aidid and Ali Mani, were fighting each other as well as the UN and US. Aidid's tribe, the Hawir, met with Abu Hafs. They agreed to cooperate with each other to take the UN out of Mogadishu by force in military fashion. Abu Hafs was happy about this meeting. In March 1997, Odeh was given a mission by Osama bin Laden to go back to Somalia to evaluate the situation there. Essam al-Ridi, the Egyptian pilot who flew bin Laden's jet from Arizona to Khartoum Airport in 1992, where it subsequently sat on the tarmac, unused, for more than a year. Al-Ridi tells how he was asked to get the plane flying again. I had a call in November 1993 stating that the airplane is still parked outside for maybe a year and a half, and Osama would like me to take it and try to do some business with it instead of just parking it there. I said I will try to check the market near Cairo, and if there is any possibility that we could generate any business with it, I will call you back. But there is one other security matter here, the fact by then Osama bin Laden was very much exposed in the Egyptian media. He was not, of course, accepted by the Egyptian government. So I indicated my concern. I took a flight to Khartoum. We start discussing about the aircraft and checking it and make sure that it is in a flyable condition. I would say it was in a very terrible condition because we had melted tires from the heat and standing in the same spot for a long time. The engine intakes and outtakes were full of sand due to sandstorms in Khartoum. No batteries. We had a problem finding the keys initially. We also needed to locate the batteries and charge them, and then we cleaned the engine's intake and outlets. We inflated the tires. We asked the mechanic to charge the hydraulic systems. We had the first engine start with a lot of fire coming out of the engine. It must have been due to some leftover sand. But anyway, after we managed to have a start, I decided to fly the aircraft, and then after we do some extensive checks relating to the avionics equipment, we took off. It flew fine. We had some problem with the power setting. I decided to make a touch and go, which is a land without a first stop. Again, took off again for another circuit, made another touch, took off for the number three circuit, and we decided to stop. I was satisfied then by the engine parameters that it would be flyable, so decided to stop. To my surprise, I could not really stop the aircraft. We lost the main hydraulic or the main brake system. I tried the alternate brake system, and I was actually talking to my first officer, who doesn't know anything about the aircraft, that I'm doing this now and I'm doing this now as a way of making sure that I'm doing the act and also making him up to speed with what's going on. So I said, we've lost the main brakes, I'm using the alternate. We've lost the alternate brakes, I'm using the handbrakes. We basically lost all kind of brakes. We could not really stop the aircraft. The last option would be to turn off the engines, to reduce the propulsion of the aircraft forward. So we shut down the engines. We were still going on the runway, running out of runway. The speed we were was about 60 knots when we hit a sand pile off the runway. The first two things that came to my mind is, of course, the safety of the first officer. Secondly, is how to leave Khartoum as soon as I can. By then, of course, the tower and everybody else could see where the aircraft is going. This aircraft was very unique to Khartoum. There is no such private jet aircraft at Khartoum International Airport. So because of our takeoff after a year and a half, everybody was really focusing on what we are doing. It's a very explosive situation. It's an aircraft accident. I'm the only one who flew this aircraft. Everybody knows that it is Osama bin Laden's aircraft. I wouldn't like to be seen in association with Osama at the time. So I was very concerned to leave. Went back to the Hilton. Packed, I went to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Lucien Kerchtou, the Moroccan who testified in the Al-Qaeda trial in New York in early 2001. He explains how Al-Qaeda increased its focus on operations in Kenya in the years preceding its 1998 attack on the U.S. Embassy in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. In 1993, A member of Al-Qaeda told me that they need me to go to Kenya from Pakistan to study flying, and one day I will be Osama bin Laden's pilot. After the registration in the flying school, they gave me all documents that they need, and I fill all the forms, and they told me to go to the immigration service to get the permit to study in Kenya. I was helping other people of Al-Qaeda in Nairobi, the Kenyan capital. Some people of Al-Qaeda, they were in Somalia, and if somebody needs help while he's transiting in Nairobi for them to travel to Sudan, if he needs a translator or any assistance, I was there to do that. I met many people there. They were going to Somalia to train people there. They were against the presence of the United Nations in Somalia. They, the members of Al-Qaeda, helped some Somalis. They wanted to put some explosives in a car and to put it inside a compound of United Nations. And they didn't succeed to do that. They told me that they were in a house in Mogadishu, the Somali capital, and one of the nights, one of the U.S. helicopters was shot. They had some shooting in the next house where they were living, and they were scared, and the next day they left because they were afraid that they will be caught by the Americans. Abu Mohammed Amriki, Ali Mohammed, the American, the first time he came with other people to my apartment in Nairobi, probably the end of 94 or early 95, and they were using it to develop pictures and all their stuff of surveillance of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya. A complaint against Ali Mohammed was filed in the Southern District of New York in September 1998. Key excerpts follow of an affidavit filed by FBI Special Agent Daniel Coleman, who is generally considered to be the most effective agent the Bureau has ever had in its investigation of Al-Qaeda. Daniel Coleman, being duly sworn, deposes and says that he is a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and charges as follows. Osama bin Laden had a particular need for United States citizens to aid Al-Qaeda, as persons with United States passports could travel freely without raising suspicion. The 1997 interview by the FBI. During an October 1997 interview by the FBI, Mohammed admitted that he trained Osama bin Laden's bodyguards in the Sudan following an unsuccessful assassination attempt against bin Laden. I know from other investigations that such an attempt occurred in 1994. Mohammed advised that the Sudanese intelligence service provided perimeter security for bin Laden, but that Mohammed had trained the guards who provided the inner security. Mohammed stated that he lived in bin Laden's house in Khartoum at the time of such training. Mohammed also advised that he was in Somalia during the United States intervention overseas and knew that bin Laden's people were responsible for the killing of the United States soldiers in Somalia. Mohammed further confirmed that in or about 1991, he went to Afghanistan to take bin Laden to Pakistan and on to the Sudan. Mohammed stated that he did this because he loved bin Laden and believed in him. Mohammed further admitted that he had done training in Afghanistan. Still later, Mohammed admitted that he had trained people in war zones and added that war zones can be anywhere. Mohammed indicated that he knew lots of people and was well trusted and could put people together with people that they need. Mohammed further stated that one did not need a fatwa to go against the United States, since it was obvious that the United States was the enemy. Wherefore, your deponent respectfully requests that the defendant Ali Abdel Saud Mohammed, a.k.a. Abu Omar, a.k.a. Omar, be imprisoned or bailed, as the case may be. Daniel Coleman, Special Agent, Federal Bureau of Investigation. Ali Mohammed, U.S. citizen of Egyptian origin. This is a partial transcript of his plea bargain hearing before Judge Sand in the Southern District of New York on October 20th, 2000. Your Honor, in the early 1980s, I became involved with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad Organization. In the early 1990s, I was introduced to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is the organization headed by Osama bin Laden, through my involvement with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. In 1992, I conducted military and basic explosives training for Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. In 1991, I helped transport Osama bin Laden from Afghanistan to the Sudan when I engaged in these activities. In late 1993, I was asked by bin Laden to conduct surveillance of American, British, French, and Israeli targets in Nairobi. Among the targets I did surveillance for was the American embassy. These targets were selected to retaliate against the United States for its involvement in Somalia. I later went to Khartoum, where my surveillance files and photographs were reviewed by Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden looked at the picture of the American embassy and pointed to where a truck could go as a suicide bomber. In 1994, bin Laden sent me to Djibouti to do surveillance on several facilities, including French military bases and the American embassy. In 1994, after an attempt to assassinate bin Laden, I went to the Sudan to train bin Laden's bodyguards, security detail. I trained those conducting the security of the interior of his compound and coordinated with the Sudanese intelligence agents who were responsible for the exterior security. I was aware of certain contacts between Al-Qaeda and Al-Jihad organization on one side and Iran and Hezbollah, an Iranian terrorist group, on the other side. I arranged security for a meeting in the Sudan between Imad Magnia, Hezbollah's chief, and bin Laden. Magnia had masterminded the attack on the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut that killed 241 U.S. soldiers. Hezbollah provided explosives training for Al-Qaeda and Al-Jihad. Iran supplied Egyptian Jihad with weapons. Iran also used Hezbollah to supply explosives that were disguised to look like rocks. I was involved in the Egyptian Islamic Jihad Organization, and the Islamic Jihad Organization had a very close link to Al-Qaeda, the organization for bin Laden. And the objective of all this, just to attack any Western target in the Middle East, to force the government of the Western countries to pull out from the Middle East, based on the Marine Barracks explosion in Beirut in 1983. During the mid-90s, Al-Qaeda was primarily based in Sudan. However, graduates of its training camps in Afghanistan had already spread around the world. Ramzi Youssef was the mastermind of the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993 that killed six and that was intended to bring the Twin Towers down. Youssef had trained at an Al-Qaeda training camp, although it seems he may have never met bin Laden, and is the nephew of Khaled Sheikh Mohammed, who oversaw Al-Qaeda's 9/11 operation. After fleeing Manhattan following the attack on the Trade Center on February 26, 1993, Youssef was finally captured in Pakistan 2 years later. Following is an FBI report, interview of Ramzi Ahmed Youssef, February 7, 1995. At approximately 10:37 a.m., on 2/7/95, Ramzi Ahmed Youssef, shortly after being arrested by Pakistani military officials, was interviewed by FBI special agents at a military station in Islamabad, Pakistan. Youssef was asked what his name is, and he stated, "I have many." But he stated he is presently using Ali Baloch, date of birth 2/15/66. Youssef was asked, "Is he Ramzi Ahmed Youssef?" And he stated that he was Youssef, and that the individual in the FBI wanted flyer is, in fact, him. Youssef was fingerprinted at the military station with a preliminary indication that his prints match Youssef. Youssef stated that his real name is Abdul Basit, date of birth 4/27/68, and that he was born in Kuwait. Youssef was verbally advised of his rights, and then the special agent wrote out in longhand his rights and read them to Youssef. Youssef advised he understood his rights, does not want an attorney, and will voluntarily talk. Youssef was asked if he committed the World Trade Center bombing, and he stated, "I masterminded the explosion." Youssef stated he purchased the materials to build the bomb from City Chemicals in Jersey City, New Jersey. Youssef stated the World Trade Center bombing cost less than $20,000. Youssef stated he built the bomb used in the World Trade Center bombing. Youssef declined to state who provided the money, but he stated the money partly came from friends in Pakistan. Youssef said that because of a lack of funds, the World Trade Center was not as successful as he desired. Youssef stated he was hoping for a 250,000 casualties, but could not obtain the funds to complete the bomb to his satisfaction. Youssef stated the reason for the bombings was because of the U.S. military, financial, and political support of Israel. Youssef talked at length about Israel being an illegal state and that Israel is committing criminal acts against Muslims. Youssef stated that the American people would need to convince Washington of changing Israeli policy, and this would happen by bombing various locations in the U.S. Youssef stated that he was most affected by a BBC report where Israeli soldiers broke the hand of a Palestinian using a rock. Youssef stated he has no personal agenda with the U.S., only the U.S.-Israeli policy. Youssef stated that he was born in Kuwait and lived there for 20 years until the Iraqi war against Iran, when his family moved to Pakistan. Youssef stated that his family was originally from Pakistan. He attended high school in Kuwait, and from 1986 to 1989 attended the West Glamorgan Institute of Higher Learning in the United Kingdom. Youssef stated he earned a higher national diploma in electronics, and the course was called Computer-Aided Electronics. In 1989, he returned to Kuwait and worked as a communications engineer at the National Computer Center for the Minister of Planning. After Iraq invaded Kuwait in August 1990, Youssef then moved to Pakistan. After moving to Pakistan, Youssef stated he went to various training camps in Afghanistan for a period of 6 months. Youssef described these camps as a place Arabs can get training in explosives, defensive tactics, weapons use, etc. These camps are located at various sites in Afghanistan, but Youssef declined to provide their locations or any specific information about their funding or manpower. Youssef stated that after training in Afghanistan, he returned to Pakistan and continued to read about bomb building. Youssef stated that during World War II, the U.S. dropped nuclear bombs on Japan to force Japan to surrender. Youssef advised the same logic applies to him setting off explosive devices at U.S. targets to force the U.S. to change their policy toward Israel. Youssef stated that this is an extreme approach, but believes it is the only way to force the U.S. to withdraw its support of Israel. Youssef asked the special agent several questions about executions in the U.S. and asked the length of time before executions are carried out after receiving the death penalty. Youssef stated he believes that he will be executed in the U.S.